Robert De Niro is a bounty hunter.
Did your mother ever teach you how to talk nice to people and not shoot at them?
Charles Grodin is an accountant who embezzled $15 million from the mob.
It is truly in your best interest to just relax.
I'm totally relaxed.
I want this guy taken out, and I want him taken out fast.
The mob wants him dead. The FBI want him alive.
I'm going to bring him into federal court. Do I make myself understood?
These sunglasses, they're really nice. Are they government issued, or do all you guys go like to the same store to get them?
And his bail bondsman wants him in L.A. in 72 hours.
They can't fly. They also suffer from acrophobia and claustrophobia.
I'll tell you what, if you don't cooperate, you're going to suffer from fistophobia.
Travo has a funny way of bringing people together.
Are you going to outrace the police car? You're going to outrace the police car.
Jack, where are you?
I'm in Boise, Idaho.
Those are hired killers back there.
I can't take this.
Hired to kill who?
Hired to kill this guy.
You had this guy, what, 4 days?
Who is that?
Agent Foster Grant.
You're all right, Jack.
Yeah, well, you're all right, too.
From the director of Beverly Hills Cop.
What is your plan?
You guys look like you do a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
Midnight Run.
I think it's worth noting that nothing, and I mean nothing, we do at Junk Food Cinema is a midnight run. It's never that easy. We are always fashionably late, and we're not even as fashionable as Joe Pantoliano. Let's be honest with ourselves. But what we definitely are is Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchool.com. Fuck. By FilmSchoolRejects.com. All right, you know what? We're not doing this again. No.
I already got an angry letter from Merrill.
Look, the Expedia people are very upset. I'm with you. I didn't know they were still around, but they are very upset about it. So just take our word for it. I'm Brian Salisbury, and joined as per usual, you've heard him already, just jumping in there with those interjections, novelist, screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going.
We've got to
open the show with on a slightly down note.
Sure, bring it
down. Just for a brief thing. I did not realize this was a thing. I was notified by a couple of listeners that for years they have been listening to my dog Gossamer jangle around in the background.
Oh yeah.
I would always ask you, I'm like, can you? You're like, no, I can't hear it. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I didn't think it was a thing, but apparently you guys were well aware that Gossamer was constantly running around back here. And last week we lost Gossamer. And it's very, very sad.
That's horrible.
He was the best dog in the world. He was great. As you notice, you never heard him bark because
no, it's true.
He was a good boy that loved everybody, and he loved watching movies with us. So he will be sorely missed. But I figured I've talked about it publicly about it happening, so I figured I would just kind of mention it. And you guys, if you're drinking right now, if you'd raise one to Gossamer. He was a good boy, so.
Agreed. And I am really sorry to hear that. Gossamer was always a fun fixture around here when we were recording. His favorite thing to do would be to come and put his head directly underneath the hand I tried to manipulate the mouse with. So it was like,
wait, that was his favorite thing was okay. He would come over and he would like, he's like, no, get your hand off that mouse. It should be petting me. Did it to Jessica all the time.
And I can't fault him for that. He's right. That's what I should have been doing. Mm-hmm. Instead, I was doing this silly little podcast thing. But as a big dog lover myself, it's heartbreaking when that happens. So yes, definitely raise one for Goss. And he will be sorely missed around JFC headquarters.
Which is changing also.
Yeah, what the hell? We're moving to a bigger bail bondsman's office.
This is the last time I'm going to be recording on this couch.
Man.
It's crazy. This couch is going. This couch has seen a few too many podcasts.
The semisonic song is loaded up, cued, and ready. Soon as we're done recording, folks. No, we're never going to play that song, but we could play that song, and it would be apropos.
Because it would cost us money. Probably.
It would cost us money. Yes, the Expedia people are already breathing down our necks. We don't need a one-hit wonder from the 90s also joining that class action lawsuit. So,
see, okay, you know what? I'm just going to do this for old time's sake. I'm going to do just a small little name dropping here. It's funny you mentioned Semisonic with the couch.
Watch your toes, guys.
Because Dan Wilson, the lead singer of Semisonic, actually knocked back a few on this couch a few years ago. No bullshit.
You say name drop, but if I don't know who that is, like, I'm not sure that that's a name drop. So he's I think you're fine.
He's a really talented musician. Dude.
I'm sure he is. I'm sure that he was. You know what? I bet he was fully Sonic. Of all of them, he wasn't just semi-Sonic. He was fully Sonic.
It was a weird short story that we'll do before we get into the meat of the podcast. But it was a good friend of mine from Minneapolis, Jeremy Messersmith, who's an indie musician. And he does a lot of nerd rock. So if you love nerd rock, you should definitely check out Jeremy. But he came down for South by, and I'm like, dude, come out. I'll take you out for barbecue. Because I was taking him to Mans.
I miss Mans.
Used to be right around the corner. So I'm like, dude, come over to my place. We get you an Uber. We'll walk on over. And I get a text like about an hour and a half beforehand. He's like, hey, dude, so I'm down here with, I brought a band with me to perform at South By. So I've got 14 other musicians with me. And they asked what I was doing tonight. And I mentioned I was going out for barbecue. So can I bring the band? I was like, yeah, sure. So literally, you know, an hour later, 15 members of a band all show up at my house. And Jeremy and his 14 musician friends. And so I did what any good fucking Texan would do. I brought him in and opened up the beer fridge, and we knocked back a few. Then we walked down, had some barbecue, came back here, just had a great time. It was an amazing night. Everyone was awesome. They were all super talented. They were all super fun and funny. And this one guy kept dropping stories every once in a while, like, oh yeah, no, that reminds me of this time I was playing with the Dixie Chicks. And, you know, it's like, huh. You know, hey, this guy's been around. He's played a couple. It was just Dan, and we were just chatting, and so had a great night. Chatted, shook hands on the way out. Everybody left, and thanked me for the hospitality. And 5 minutes later, my phone goes off. It's Dan Wilson, you know, tweet, and thanks to Massive Worm for all the hospitality, for taking us out for great barbecue and great stories. And I look at it, and it's Dan Wilson, lead singer of Semisonic. And I'm like, Wait, what? What, Dan?
Did you guys, while he was here, talk all about chemistry?
No, we literally sat and talked about all just sorts of nerd stuff and movies and music and coming down for South By and what it's like in Austin. And so many of them are from Minneapolis. So we talked about Minneapolis, which is my, you know, home away from home, and which is your home away from home as well.
We
do love the MSP. So it was just one of those weird things. Like, wait a second. Like, I've heard this guy's song like 12 trillion times, half of them at strip clubs at the end of the night. And it's like, it was just a very surreal moment. And every once in a while, because we follow each other on Twitter and we talk back and forth, and every once in a while, he's like, man, I was just the other day thinking about that night down in Austin for South By. And I'm like, ah, me too, man. That night, that was a really cool night. So it was just this cool night where I filled my fucking house with all these great musicians. And one of them turned out to be Dan. So
I don't mean to be callous, but can we also raise a beer for Mans? Because condolences to the fact that we lost Mans.
It closed up while I was shooting Strange, and so I missed the last day of Mans.
I feel like if anybody else in my life said that to me, I would assume it was a filthy euphemism for something, but you literally mean shooting Doctor Strange.
Yes.
That's very interesting. and to somewhat wrangle this podcast back on track, which is actually apropos of the movie we're talking about, because the best laid plans and so on and so forth. You did mention Minneapolis, and I think that's a good place to plug a couple of live dates for Junk Food Cinema coming up.
What?
I know. We are going to be at Denver Comic Con, and we've been saying that for a while, the weekend of the 15th through the 17th. What you may not have heard yet, because I haven't announced it yet, is that we're actually playing that Friday, where our show is that Friday night, which I believe is the 15th. And I can officially announce that the movie we're covering is The Monster Squad. And we will have not one, but two original cast members from Monster Squad on that episode with us. I am super fucking excited about it.
Yeah, you know Andre. Have you met Ryan before?
I have not met Ryan before.
Sweet fucking dude. Like, they were at Chattanooga this year, and nice. I saw their documentary, which they're showing at Denver Comic Con. So if you get a chance, go see that documentary when you get the chance. It's playing on the circuit. I know it's also, I'm pretty certain it's also going to be playing at Cinepocalypse, where I will be the next week. I'm probably going to see that documentary two or three more times just over the course of
you're gonna bop until you drop, you're gonna dance until your feet fall off.
But it's a good doc about the not just Monster Squad, but the fandom around it and the weirdness of how this movie went from being a flop to being an obscure cult classic that was really hard to find to being remembered as one of those touchstone movies of this era. Like, at this point in history, it's hard to think that Monster Squad was a movie that not a lot of people knew existed for like 20, 25 years.
Oh, I will freely admit, I didn't know about it at all until I moved to Austin, because I grew up on the Goonies and no one ever fucking told me that Monster Squad existed.
And also, you will. Oh, you know what? I'm glad you did this, because we were just joking about earlier about how we could possibly squeeze this in. You will recognize a large number of people interviewed in it, which include, like Jen Yamato and a bunch of our film critic friends, and Adam Green and Joe Lynch of the Movie Crypt. Our sister podcast, they show up. And of course, Joe Lynch gets so much screen time because he's actually like, this is a huge touchstone movie for him. But yeah, so that doc is really great. Check it out when you run across it on the scene. Come and see us at Denver Comic Con live with guests.
Yeah, that's live. Super excited about that. And I have to say, not to be rude, if the Movie Crypt is our sister podcast, we have a really ugly sister.
Those are sexy, sexy men, dude.
Oh, no. But as a sister, I guess, that podcast.
I think we're the ugly sister.
We might be the ugly sister. That's entirely possible. Hey, and I also mentioned we are going to be at Convergence this year, which is actually the weekend after July 4th. So we haven't figured out what movie we're doing for that yet, but that should be a lot of fun as well. And you can always follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, if you like the show as much as I am starting to dislike Cargill's.com jokes, you can go to Patreon.
What?
No, it's fine. Take your time. We got all night.
.com.
Yes, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And you can, for as little as a dollar an episode, financially support this show and you get access to bonus content. And I will be real with you for just a second. I'll bring it down again for just a second. Tomorrow,
realest junk food ever.
Well, you're shuttering the doors of Junk Food HQ. I feel like it's time to like really get personal. So I will tell you that as of this recording, tomorrow, my son turns one. And you guys have been there literally through the whole process. And I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've read it in books or seen a TV show or a movie in the 80s. Babies are expensive. And I credit you guys and your support for the reason that I've been able to keep my head above water and keep things comfortable at home, even with having two kids and one of them being an infant. Like, I cannot tell you how much your support has helped me get through, you know, that first year if you have kids, you know what I'm talking about.
This podcast would not exist without you guys. Since we're being real,
yep.
I have a super PAC schedule, and Brian...
Wait, you're a member of a super PAC? I thought we were trying to abolish those. Okay, you heard it here first.
501C.
God damn it.
No,
you're a robot?
I have a really packed schedule. Trying to work around someone who has to work two jobs would be insane. So you guys allow Brian to be a real American who only has one full-time job and then one side gig to help pay the bills for his children. America, fuck yeah.
You, I want to thank you for my side gig.
Yeah, you guys really do honestly keep the lights on here. We would not be able to do this without your support. So thank you guys very much.
As we're literally about to turn the lights off here at Junk Food HQ. I shouldn't say that because people are going to get the wrong
because
idea.
Because we are moving to a much bigger place. You do realize that when the weather's nice, we'll be able to podcast by the pool.
Oh, that just sounds all kinds of dangerous.
I don't know. Water and alcohol mix, right?
That's with electricity is more what I'm thinking. I mix water and alcohol all the time. But when you start trying to handle a board while floating on a fucking raft, I mean, that's basically a suicide attempt.
It's not really a huge pool. It's not like I'm moving into some palatial estate. But it's nice. This was my starter house. It's been awesome, but it's been 10 years and we're moving on up. So there we are.
Awesome.
So,
we came here to do a movie, right?
And not only a movie, literally one of the most perfect movies of its type ever made. It is a movie with a cast who is firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every actor in this movie is giving one of the best performances of their life, or coming close to it. It is a movie that is so spectacularly well written and structured that it is just perfection. And it's one of those movies that you've never heard anybody go, you know, I really don't like Midnight Run. But people often forget how much they love Midnight Run.
People forget.
And then revisit it and go, holy shit, this movie really is perfect. And it is. Midnight Run is a perfect comedy. It is a perfect road movie. It is a perfect buddy movie. It plays with all sorts of fun kind of structures. It has some of the best, wonderful buried guns of this type of movie. And it just delivers and keeps putting a smile on your face time and time again.
It's premier buddy movie. It is premier road trip movie. It is premier crime comedy. There is so many subgenres that I love that Midnight Run is just tick, 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 tick all the way down the list. And it's a movie that, much like a lot of the movies we talk about on this show, was going to be something else, was slated at another studio to be a completely different movie until that studio didn't like where it was going and dumped it off to Universal, who put all of their trust into director Martin Brest, who directed, you know, movies like Beverly Hills Cop, For the Love of God. Like, you want to talk about somebody who understands how to do action comedies.
Yes, let's talk about a director who is one of the greatest directors in one decade and then became one of the worst by the end of his career.
It's an odd turn.
It's a really odd turn. He made one notorious movie and one movie that is forgotten that was notorious at the time. And that's the end of his career. Like, he soared so high that he got near the sun and Icarus Dunn fell down into fucking Geely.
Well, it's just like, it really is a perfect parabola when you start looking at his career, because it's like Beverly Hills Cop, oh my God, Midnight Run, Scent of a Woman, Meet Joe Blow. Wait, what's going on? What's going on? Geely.
And the thing is, I was one of three people in the world who actually enjoyed Geely, because Geely is a movie that was not made for anyone but someone like me. Because Geely's literally a movie where they're like, hey, you know what would be great? If we took a romantic comedy, the kind that women like, and put it with a bloody gangster film that includes people getting their heads blown off. People will love that. Something for the men and the women. And I'm sitting there going, I love romantic comedies and people getting their heads blown off. And nobody else, crickets. Like, literally that movie. I would never watch it again. But when I watch it, I'm like, there's moments in that movie that I really like. There's some that I really don't.
I'm gonna quote Midnight Run for just a second. Nothing personal, but fuck off, all right?
Fuck off. Yeah. But yeah, he was someone like, I mean, that run right there of
that midnight run, you might say.
No, because there's nothing midnight run about his early career.
But his late career definitely went off the rails, which is, again, this movie is like, I feel like a perfect double feature would be Planes, Trains, and Automobiles immediately followed by Midnight Run, because Midnight Run, the comedy of Midnight Run is almost the exact same structural comedy of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It is a Murphy's Law, a Murphy's Lawmedy. It is literally just everything that can go wrong when all you have to do is get from point A to point B, a National Lampoon's Vacation type movie.
I feel that. Although I think you accidentally programmed one of the best double features, the best double feature possible for this, and one of the best triple features I've ever watched in my life. Because one day you showed
that's right.
this with Running Scared.
Yes.
And then we chased it down with Thief.
Now, interesting to note, and I did not know this at the time, Thief and Midnight Run have the same cinematographer, which is quite a compliment, because if you've ever seen Thief, you go back and listen to our episode about it, that movie is shot so gorgeously.
Oh, it's so good. Well, both of these movies are. This one, though, what's interesting about Midnight Run is Midnight Run feels like the epitome of a studio film, even though it was a film that was so not a studio film at its time. It's just, it's peak studio. And not only is it
studio.
Not only is it peak studio, it is. Okay, so we got to talk about something for a moment.
Do I need to Jürgen?
No. Here is one of the things about Midnight Run. Midnight Run is the last glory moment of a guy who is one of the biggest stars of the 80s that no one remembers being one of the biggest stars of the 80s. Charles Grodin was fucking huge. He was a big star. He opened movies. There was a period of time, if you listen to 80s all over, you hear this all the time, because yeah. Grodin was in fucking everything. And there was a period of time where Grodin had like 3 to 5 movies coming out a year that he was just working and became huge. And so putting Robert De Niro with Charles Grodin was just printing money.
Yeah.
And this is the movie that an entire generation remembers Charles Grodin as. They remember him as a supporting actor in other things, but he was the big draw in, you know, he was a very interesting part of Midnight Run. But no, it was not that at all. It's so strange to think about. It would be like, I mean, the kind of draw he is, it would be like he was, I think the best way to put him is he was the Steve Carell of that era. Might be a good way to put it, but where everybody loves Steve Carell and everybody goes and sees Steve Carell movies and he's done a lot of stuff. And then he just did a couple of films that weren't so great and just kind of dropped off and everyone forgot that Charles Grodin was huge.
Mm-hmm.
But he has never been better than he is in this movie.
Agreed. And one of the things that is tremendous about Midnight Run in the context of this show, it exists in a junk food cinema nexus. Almost every name attached to this, and almost every name that was almost attached to this, and almost like every reason that this movie exists is in our wheelhouse. For example,
and we've talked about many of these people. We've done whole episodes on some of these.
Yes,
people.
We have. But
so let's go through it.
For example, Robert De Niro. The reason he wanted to do this movie in the first place is because he had just done The Untouchables, and was like, you know, I enjoyed playing a larger-than-life gangster, but I think I want to do something a little more low-key and something comedic. So it was entirely wanting to kind of left turn away from The Untouchables, which we've talked about last summer, is the reason he's on board with this. And then, of course, we've talked about Martin Brest, who did Beverly Hills Cop. We've talked about Beverly Hills Cop 2. Martin Brest believed in Charles Grodin so much that he fought Paramount Pictures to the point that they dumped this movie, because Paramount Pictures wanted a big, big star to be up against Robert De Niro to really put butts in seats. And they thought, well, why don't we take this script, this amazing, amazing screenplay, and let's make this character of the Duke, let's make it a woman. And that way we also have the sexual tension. And they wanted to cast Cher. And you have to understand The 1988 Cher is the Cher that's got a fucking gold statue on her mantle.
Oh, yeah. No, she was, yeah, she was huge.
Yes.
And she had been a joke early in the 80s, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, the singer is trying to be an actress now. And boy, did she prove everybody wrong for a decade. And yeah, she was a megastar. So I could definitely see why they'd be like, yeah, we don't want Charles Grodin, we want Cher. That's a name that's big enough to eclipse someone like a Grodin.
So when Martin Brest turned down that idea, they said, okay, well then we want Robin Williams to play the Duke. We want Robert De Niro and Robin Williams to play these two leads. And somebody, not Martin Brest, but somebody reached out to Robin Williams' people, and they were so excited about him auditioning. But in the meantime, Martin Brest had seen Charles Grodin's audition. And he, if you watch this movie, it's pretty damn clear. If he walked in the room and did that, you couldn't cast anybody else.
Yeah.
However, they got so pissed off that he refused to audition Robin Williams, they dumped the project, and Universal comes in, picks it up, and basically says to Martin Brest, do whatever it is that you want to do with this movie.
Because the script was genius.
It was so fucking good. And I will say, it's about a 70-30 split in the final product between what's on the page and what was improvised in the moment. Because Robert De Niro, like, this is one of those movies that I feel like I forget sometimes because I'm a little bit older, and my era of Robert De Niro is not as prestigious as the young, hungry, amazing Robert De Niro who changed the game in a lot of ways. You know, I'm sort of more the like late 90s, early 2000s Robert De Niro.
You came in at the point that he started satirizing himself.
Yes.
Like he literally, yes. The Rocky and Bullwinkle, where he literally satirizes himself.
Yeah.
He literally looks into a mirror and does the "you talking to me" like gag. Like he starts making fun of Taxi Driver in the middle of this. Like he's just like, he doesn't give a fuck anymore. He was just right. Doing big comedies. He is never in his entire career. He is never more likable than he is in this movie.
I would agree with that entirely. And there are also moments in this movie that I remember as I'm watching it for the show that I remembered. Oh, that's right. Robert De Niro is an incredible fucking actor.
Yeah.
It's so weird that I have to be reminded of that. But you get to a point where, like, you've seen him in The Fucking Intern, and you're like, I don't know who Robert De Niro is anymore. But I watch this movie, and I watch the beats where he reconnects with his daughter, and he's struggling to get a word out.
And he can't.
He can't, and, like, the little moments, the little comedic, and I say nods, he literally can make me laugh, and did with a nod in this movie. Like, it is incredible the work he is doing. What's even funnier than Robert De Niro in this movie, however, is the movie that he almost took instead of this. He really wanted the lead in Penny Marshall's Big. Can you fucking imagine Big with, instead of Tom Hanks, it's Robert De Niro? Like, I don't know how to get a job. I don't know how a check works. That's a woman's boob. I've never seen one before. I'm going to get an apartment. I want to be a kid again. I'm scared. Like, it's just, that's a fucking weird movie. Like, in my head, though, there's a part of me that wants to go to the parallel universe where Robert De Niro's in Big.
To see the really creepy version of Big? Because Big is already creepy.
It's already
enough.
A creepy movie, guys.
Like, there's Big is a problematic film.
Yes.
Like, Big has a really big, huge
there
heart,
it is.
And it's adorable. But Big has some problems.
Big has a big problem as well.
big little child molesting problem.
Yeah. That Big is a movie that if it were made today, if it played in your neighborhood, it would have to go door to door letting you know that it was playing in your neighborhood.
That's exactly what would happen.
I'm just saying.
There is a moment in this movie towards the end in which Robert De Niro just gives this little smile. And Yaphet Kotto is like, what are you smiling about? And he just goes, first time in a long time that I feel like a cop again. And like in that moment, your heart grows three sizes.
Yes.
And you're like, I love this movie so hard.
Right.
And it's just this small little moment. But he sells it. The way he says it makes you forgive every bit of dickery that character has had through the rest of the movie.
Now, you mentioned a name just now. I'm going to ask you
to repeat. You mean Yaphet Kotto?
Oh, yes. The
longtime favorite of junk food cinema, Yaphet Kotto?
Junk food legend, Yaphet Kotto.
Goddamn right.
An entire episode devoted to Yaphet Kotto playing, if you know what? I realized, like, you know, I spent my whole life thinking that when someone referred to a federal agent as a Fed, they were just shortening the word federal. It turns out because Yaphet Kotto epitomizes the, I'm so fucking fed up with everyone I work with that I am the fed up Fed. And that's what I love most about him in this movie. He's so goddamn sick of his coworkers. There's so many moments where he just, like, somebody comes in and is like, this just came in, one of my favorite scenes. We just got this notice, and he's like, is it going to upset me? I'd say there's a good chance. he's so angry at everyone he works with.
Well, that's one of the brilliant things about this movie is it's literally about several big, powerful people who all have idiots for minions.
Yes, yes, yes.
All
yes,
chasing yes, yes. after one guy who's pretty much one of the best guys there is at his job. And a guy who's also hyper smart with him. But everybody... They keep just either outsmarting them or getting lucky and just dodging the bullet.
And that's the thing that I think people forget about Midnight Run is that this whole movie hinges on Charles Grodin because his character should, like, it should not be the it's called Midnight Run for a reason because in the bail bonds industry, a midnight run is literally something you can just do real quick. It's an easy job. He should be an easy job. He's not even a real criminal.
He's an accountant.
He's an accountant who embezzled money from the mob and gave it to charity.
And so, got caught doing
it. Got caught doing it. And then skipped bail, and everyone knows exactly where he is. Like, they find him so quickly.
That's actually what's interesting, is no one else can find him.
That's true. No, you're
except
right.
Except Robert De Niro.
Because Robert De Niro has magical wizard technology.
Well, there's that, but there's actually, there is one element to this movie that is magical, and we'll get into that in a little bit.
You guys are the dumbest bounty hunters I've ever seen!
So we have Yaphet Kotto.
We have Yaphet Kotto playing the one of the foils of the movie. Yeah. Like, for the first 95% of this movie, he's one of the bad guys. He's an asshole. He's a piece of shit. He's a federal agent who's literally impeding another investigation.
Yes.
He is trying to prevent this prisoner from ending up in the hands of the police department who has a warrant for him because he doesn't want them to have it, even though they have not arrested Charles Grodin. They want to.
Yes.
But they are superseding the local police department because they want to have him as an informant. So, they don't want him to see justice. They want to offer him a deal and get him out of that trouble. And so that's one team going after this. On the other side is...
Well, look, I need to do this. I need to Jürgen pause now and actually go back and do my fucking job as the host of a movie podcast and tell you, if you haven't seen it, what this movie's plot is, because we've kind of been dancing around it but not actually told you. The plot of this movie is that Robert De Niro plays a bounty hunter by the name of Jack Walsh, who works for a bail bondsman named Eddie Moscone, who is played by Joey Pence.
Joey Pantoliano.
I'm fucking in the movie, motherfucker.
Junk food alum from a favorite of ours called the Final Terror.
By the way, does it tickle you just a little bit that when you go back and listen to 80s All Over and they get to a movie we've covered and they both just fucking hate it? And you're like, I mean, we kind of liked it.
Every once in a while, they'll go, you know, we really fucking hated this thing. But if you want to hear a different take on it, Cargill and Brian don't fucking hate this
movie. Sometimes it's okay to sit at the kids' table. And that is like when they're like hating on Final Terror, I'm like, you know what? I'm okay. I'm okay being at the kids' table.
Yeah,
that's
you
fine.
Know what? I'm fine loving a movie that you guys didn't get. That's totally. Okay.
Don't start a pod war. Do not start a pod war. God damn it, we talked about this.
Never start a pod war in Asia.
No. That's the only slightly lesser well-known adage. Anyway, so yes, so Eddie is in a bit of a bind because Eddie just shelled out $450,000. He put up a bond for Jonathan the Duke Mardukas, played of course by Charles Grodin, who is the guy who just embezzled $15 million from the mafia. The mafia in Chicago led by...
Dennis Farina,
because if you want anyone who's from Chicago in your movie, you either get Dennis Farina or you get the entire cast of Saturday Night Live in that Da Bear sketch, because those are the most Chicago things you will ever come across in your lifetime.
And here, he is at perhaps his most detestable. Like, he is... Like in many scenes with him, he has an advisor, And that advisor is played by Philip Baker Hall.
Okay, how fucking stacked is your lineup when Philip Baker Hall is on the bench?
Yeah, he's just constantly there to say, I'd advise against this. Like, as your lawyer, I advise against it. Like, he's like, it's all, his only job, Philip Baker Hall, is to sit there and tell Dennis Farina, this is a bad idea. And then Dennis Farina always says, you know what? Sit down, have a cream soda, get the fuck out of my face. Like, it's, and you just
want to get up and I'll bury this phone in your fucking head.
He does. Yes. He's so good at making you hate the living shit out of him. He doesn't do anything awful throughout the film. Like, he doesn't, you don't see Dennis Farina kill anybody. You don't see him, you know, smacking anybody around, but he threatens to bury a phone in his employees' heads.
Yeah.
And you fucking hate the guy and can't wait to watch him fucking go down. And of course, when you get the backstory of who he really is and how much he ties into this plot, this movie becomes spectacular.
Also, he's the thread line that kind of insinuates that Thief and Midnight Run exist in the same universe. Because apparently he didn't die in that shootout with James Caan and went from being a low-ranking bodyguard to the head of the goddamn crime family in Chicago. So congratulations, Dennis Farina. So on top of... So, yeah, Robert De Niro's offered $50,000 to go get the Duke.
100.
Well, that's the thing. And initially, he's offered $50,000.
And then he demands 100.
Then he demands 100,000. And so he goes and he gets the Duke, and he's in New York. All he has to do is bring him from New York to LA in 5 days, get him here by Friday midnight, you got your money. Boom, everything's great. Well, unfortunately, not only is Robert De Niro after the Duke, the mob is after the Duke. The mob meets up with Robert De Niro and offers him $1 million to give them the Duke. He refuses because he's never, and this is very, very, very important.
Muy importante.
He has never taken a payoff in his life. And he says that. And I think this is a really interesting touch about this screenplay, is because this is a down and out character who is down and out because he refuses to compromise.
Because he's too noble. And that's the beauty and the brilliance of this movie, is that this is a character who believes in righteousness. He is what we call lawful good.
Yep.
He believes very, very strongly in justice and the law, and that you do the right thing. You do not take a payoff.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we find out that over a decade ago, he was offered a payoff by some heroin dealer, who of course you find out is Dennis Farina, and that when he refused to take it, it turns out the rest of his department was on the take, and they planted evidence on him to make it look like he was dirty, and he ended up refusing to take the money and ended up getting booted out of the force. His wife divorced him, ended up marrying someone else from his department. He lost his wife, who he still loves, lost his kid, wasn't connected with his kid, and now is a skip tracer running around bringing in, jumping criminals. And so who does he end up with? In fact, this is what's so great about this. Like, this movie's so tight because what feels like cheap exposition actually makes so much more sense in retrospect. So you get this scene where Joe Pantoliano is like, hey, do you know who the Duke is? Have you heard of the Duke? And he's like, yeah, I've heard of the Duke. Well, how? I read about it in the papers. And what you find out is, of course he knows who the Duke is, because the Duke has just shanked the guy who fucked him over 10 years ago. He follows this in and out. And so he ends up going to get this guy to turn him in for these crimes, which, by the way, he also knows is going to help torpedo this guy who fucked him. So he's going to get some dirty fucking guy that worked for the dirty fucking guy that fucked him over. So, yes, he's going to get this guy. He's not going to take any shit. And then on the course of the road, they slowly begin to understand each other. And we find out that the Duke really is a guy that got caught up in something he shouldn't and just kind of wanted to fuck over a bad guy, but also enrich himself. Like, that was part of the plan. But he thought he wasn't going to get caught. And then we find out that De Niro actually is this super stand-up guy. And then we get to one of the most perfect third acts, I think, that exist in this kind of a film. Like, the way all the pieces fall into place, the way the alliances shift, there is this moment where he gets fucked. He's just screwed. He's lost the Duke. He's been arrested by the FBI. He's going to do 10 years for impersonating an officer for one of the best jokes in the movie.
So good.
Where he keeps impersonating Mosley.
All you guys named Mosley?
What?
It would appear he has your identification, sir. The looks. Oh, my God. Just Yaphet Kotto communicating so much. I will destroy you in one glance.
And then when all the pieces fall together and he realizes how badly fucked everyone is, he realizes Charles Grodin's going to get murdered. He realizes that everything has gone wrong. He works out a plan and he decides to offer Mosley a deal. And so he starts laying out the plan and starts explaining to all the dimwit guys who work with Mosley all the laws that they're going to catch this guy on.
Oh, that's so great.
And the way Yaphet Kotto just starts to smile softly in that scene is one of the best moments in this whole movie. Like, the way he just smiled, you're just like, I like this guy. Like, you get, like, it's like all of a sudden, it's, I've talked about this before on other podcasts. It is one of my favorite things about movies, period. When you have two people who are justifiably on opposite sides of a conflict, and then one of them comes around and they have that moment where they have mutual threat and they become bros, and the bro moment, the moment where they they just, like, they connect, is one of the best moments there is in cinema. Watching people get over their bullshit to work together for good and then ending up friends at the end is really one of the best through lines in cinema. Like, it's one thing to have an opposing force and then conquer that force. That's great. But watching people who shouldn't get along or who don't get along suddenly become friends really does, you know, really does make your heart grow three sizes, to use that.
Are you reading the VHS box for Turner and Hooch? Is that what's happening right now?
I love Turner and Hooch.
I love it too. Why do people hate Turner and Hooch?
Because dog movies got really, really stupid in that era.
You know what? You want to hate on K-9? Fine. I get it. I get it. K-9 is a wretched, wretched movie.
You think that's, well, you know what? I would save an extra. No, it is a wretched movie. The wretched movie is the sequel to K-9 starring Chuck Norris.
No. That's not a sequel to K-9. And I know this because all three of the K-9 movies are on HBO Go, and the other night I got drunk and I watched all of them.
Oh, why did you do that?
Because I don't know. Because I hate myself, I guess. Top Dog.
Top Dog. That's what it was. Fuck.
No. Which means, no. Let's track back for just a fucking sidebar for just a second.
Oh, wait.
Sidebar.
There it is. Okay, so, yeah, that means that at a certain point in time, we had Turner and Hooch as the exemplar cop in a dog movie.
Exactly what it was.
We had copycats of these dog movies.
Yes. You could not get away from fucking cop dog movies in the late 80s, early 90s. You just fucking couldn't. But Turner and Hooch, I have a soft spot for
I Turner love and Turner and Hooch. I don't give a shit who knows it. I love Turner and Hooch. I want to know where the Van Damme in a dog movie was. Because for the love of God, we should have gotten Van Damme in a dog. Jean-Claude Van Dogg. Come on! Damn it, Hollywood.
Jean-Claude Great Dane?
Yeah! Oh! Yes! Click, 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 ding!
He's still making movies.
And you know what? We might be able to afford him, so ding, 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 ding. So we have the mob after him. We have the feds after him, led by Yaphet Kotto. We also have a rival bounty hunter after him.
Because Joe Pantoliano's a piece of shit.
Such a piece of shit in this movie.
Again, one of the things that I think is so brilliant about this film is how everybody fucks this guy over in just the right way to allow us to get the ending that we want to have without him compromising his morals.
Right.
Like, literally all he does
is win
at
win,
the
win.
End is give up the money that he's due.
Yeah.
He kind of fixes, he does everything right and fixes everything correctly and decides, well, I'm just not going to have that coffee shop. And so that allows Charles Grodin to pay off one of the other best jokes in the movie.
God, the fact that, okay.
It's a joke. Again, what I love about this movie, how sharply written it is. There are jokes in this movie that are not funny the first time.
You have
to know what's coming for them to be funny. The number of times Charles Grodin's like, hey, I got money. And he's like, no, because he's not really listening to him. He's not even thinking about the fact that he has money strapped to him the entire fucking movie.
Which is so funny because through the course of their trip, and it starts when he grabs the Duke and he goes to the airport. We're getting on a plane. We're flying first class. It's over. I've won. Charles Grodin demonstrates his fucking comedic genius in this scene on the plane where he is having a fucking panic attack about flying. Keeps telling him, you know, I'm an aviophobic. I'm afraid of flying. And, you know, he just keeps going on. And then he launches into this panic attack and these things go down. It's too big.
It's too big.
Like, you want to see somebody really explore the space of a first class cabin with a broad comedic bit. It is so fucking good. And they end up getting thrown off the plane and they're going to have to take a train. And again, the Dr. Seuss-ness of this is very much like a certain John Hughes movie I mentioned before. And then, you know, that goes awry. Then they're trying to get a bus. So at a certain point in this movie, they're completely broke and having to run a scam on a small town bar to get 20s just so they could eat. And the whole time, not only is Charles Grodin not afraid of flying, he's a goddamn pilot. He's got his pilot's license and his giant coat, which you will at a certain point the first time you watch this, because you're absolutely right. It rewards repeat viewing. The first time you watch this, you will wonder, they're in the desert. Why is he still wearing that giant coat? Because there's fucking money in the coat. He's had money on him the entire time.
Yep.
And it's like this weird Ready Player One moment at the end where it's like, oh, you didn't actually want the money, you're walking away. So now that you've demonstrated you don't want it, here it all is. Oh my God, it's a great payoff. So good. Oh, I love it so much. And then, so this bumbling other bail bondsman who's chasing them, what I love about him is that he falls for the same gag about five times, where Robert De Niro's basically just, watch out, and then just punches him. And then, of course, at the end, when there's actually this like boy who cried wolf situation, it's like, no, you need to turn around because
there are literal mobsters walking towards you with guns.
But I also love that guy thinks he's got it all worked out, and he goes to the mob and he shows them a picture of Charles Grodin. And he's like, I've got him. And if you want him, it's going to cost you $2 million. And they immediately knock him out and they're like, yeah, the name of the hotel he's at is on the towels. Like, he's a fucking idiot.
He's a moron. I will. Okay, this is
moron number one and moron number two.
We do need to point out the one weird thing about this movie and why it exists in a magical universe that isn't reality.
The phone freaking?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. The phone freaking stuff makes total sense. Like, that actually.
Okay, hold on. He hijacks the phone line with a walkie-talkie somehow, and that's how he figures out the frequency. Like, finding out the frequency of the numbers dialed, that I get. How he taps into a phone line by sitting across the street with a walkie-talkie, that's some hacker shit. Like, that's some shit from actual hackers.
That is shit for somebody who used to go on stakeouts and knows how to bug a phone.
But he never enters. But that's the thing, is he never enters the house.
Well, you know what? All right.
That's my problem,
I buy it,
Cargill.
Though, as that's your problem. Here's my problem. Why does Robert De Niro have the magical ability to knock people out with one punch no matter what?
Oh, that's a whole, like, this whole thing is a Popeye sketch. Like, everybody's getting bludoed.
It's kind of like, and they fight. No, they don't fight. He just hits them and knocks them out. Like, that is his magical power, is he hits a person once and they go immediately unconscious without any repercussions.
It's, you know what? It's like the WWE, man. They've got finishing moves. Robert De Niro's finishing move is the haymaker. The other bail bondsman's finishing move is to hit people with his car door, which he does a couple of times in this movie, which actually is pretty fucking effective. He just drives by and opens the car door and knocks them out, which works, actually. But the comedy in this movie of the two of them just bickering. And it's not even really bickering. It's Robert De Niro trying to get Charles Grodin to shut the fuck up. And Charles Grodin knowing exactly how to annoy Robert De Niro.
There is a scene in this movie that I'm guessing was lifted from another movie. And it's one I still can't believe we haven't talked about yet. It's a movie with the poster hanging in my house, and it's one of those things that it's like, how have we not covered The Killers yet?
Oh, we will.
But there is a scene in The Killers where Lee Marvin is sitting with...
it's not Ronald Reagan. That's the other version. Yes, that's going to drive
me. Clu Gulager.
There you go.
And they are sitting and having a discussion, and Clu Gulager... This is forever ago. So Clu Gulager is the young kid in this movie. Like, he's the young upstart beatnik assassin.
Hold on. Ask your fucking parents, because Clu Gulager is amazing.
Well, yes. And Clu Gulager is someone that Junk Food alums should definitely know. If they don't know him from Feast, they know him from
Return of the Living Dead.
A movie called Return of the Living Fucking Dead.
Yeah.
He is a classic vintage actor who's worked with everybody. I remember meeting him one time and having lunch with him at Fantastic Fest. And we were talking about, you know, just gigs he's worked on and things like that. And I'm like, do you ever work with Charles Bronson? He goes, Charlie? Yeah, we all worked with Charlie. And it's a moment that's always stuck with me, just that he would go on and he's like, yeah, he never starred opposite him, but he was a day player on some of Charlie's stuff and he knew Charlie.
Man,
and it's like, Charlie, not Chuck.
Yeah.
Not Charles, Charlie.
Well, at that point, you're not even name dropping. You're kicking those names down the stairs like the girl from Crossroads. Like, that's insane. Like, just Charlie. That's like working at fucking Canon and you have the two Chuck piles.
Yes.
The Chuck piles.
The Chuck piles. So Clu Gulager is sitting with Lee Marvin and he's heckling Lee Marvin for his food choices. He's having a nice big juicy steak and he's like, you know how bad that is for you, right? And they're going off on that. And that exact scene plays out here in Midnight Run on the Train.
Yes.
But with fried chicken.
Yes. Which, I don't know, maybe put a pin in that for a second. There's so many moments throughout this movie where Charles Grodin makes the choice as an actor to make everything he says to Robert De Niro sound utterly sincere, to the point that you're like, is he really trying to annoy this character, Jack Walsh, or is he legitimately concerned for him? Because he plays it so earnestly that you're like, yeah, I can understand why Robert De Niro's annoyed with you, but I also can't hate you. Like, I can't dislike either person in this team. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden they spend so much of the movie handcuffed to each other. And I like both of them. It's like the fucking Defiant Ones for a couple of hours.
Yes, very much so. And what's interesting is that Grodin realizes early on that that Jack is actually a good dude.
Yeah.
That he actually means well. And as he starts peeling the onion and putting all the pieces together, he realizes just how good a dude he is and how much he sacrificed because he refused to be the bad guy. He refused to compromise his morality, even though he lost everything as a result. And that even then, the lesson wasn't, well, fuck it, I'm just going to compromise my morality whenever. It's like, no, I'm going to continue with my life being shit because I want to be the good guy. And that is what lets me sleep well at night. And it's such a glorious character motivation. It's such a good thing, because it's not something, especially in the 80s, you saw a lot of. Because in the 80s, we were suffering from the rise of the anti-hero. We've talked about this on the podcast. You know, we had America wanted to see heroes like Cabretti. You know, they wanted to see guys who didn't care so much about the rule of law as much as cared about the theory of the law. Like, it's not the letter of the law, it's the spirit. It's, we got to catch these bad guys, and maybe we got to bust a couple of heads and break a couple of laws and step on a couple of rights to do it. And that's not who this character is. Jack is not that guy. Jack's the guy who's like, no, we're going to do this the way it needs to be done. Now, he does a little light breaking and entering, a little, you know, stealing here and there, a little side stuff, but all in a way that never hurts anybody and always gets the bad guy. Like, that's, he only does stuff that is non-harmful to get the bad guy. And that's all he cares about.
Well, consider the scene I mentioned where they're so broke that Charles Grodin comes up with this scheme to walk into a bar, pretend to be an FBI agent, pretend to be Mosley, and say that he is looking for counterfeit 20s. notice in that scene, they don't take all of the 20s.
No, he's like, no, all of these are good. No,
they could have taken all of the 20s. They don't.
They don't. And he just takes what he needs, like, yeah, to move on. And it's so well done and showing, you know, the moral grayness and the lack of foresight on the part of Charles Grodin's character of the Duke, and to see the moral rigidity of Jack. It's really a fascinating dichotomy that works as they both ultimately come to like each other and yeah, become great friends and end up making sacrifices for each other. And it's just a wonderful, hilarious ride through such a well-structured, well-written movie.
Which is saying something, because the big feat of this movie for me is wrangling that chaos, because the story, the adventure they go on is so much about chaos. It's so much about everything that's going wrong. Again, Murphy's Law, everything that can go wrong does. But I've seen Robert De Niro in a movie where the comedy was supposed to go from everything that can go wrong will, and I fucking hated it. It was called Meet the Parents, and I fucking loathed that
movie.
There
are three of those.
I didn't bother with the other two because I hated the first one so much. And the reason I hated the first one so much is it was just one of those, if you would just stop for 2 seconds, Ben Stiller, just shut up and stop for a second, none of this would have happened. And it's,
well, yeah,
the chaos
that's comedy of the 90s, period.
But the chaos just seems so manufactured because nobody would actually be that stupid.
I would argue that even worse than those, because I'm no fan of those, is Analyze That, the sequel to Analyze This.
Oh, my God. I don't even remember
Analyze
That.
De Niro did a lot of bad or really lowbrow comedy. There's, if you go through De Niro's IMDb, there's a lot of cringeworthy stuff. Now, I can't bust Meet the Parents too hard. Meet the Parents was a huge hit and people thought it was funny. And this is in an era where me and comedy took a big disconnect. Like, that everybody was like, yeah, let's watch these gross out rated R comedies with Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson. And I was just like, and Vince Vaughn. And I was like, check out. This is not my thing.
Look, Cargill, I want to remind you, as you're saying this about what movies made money, they made 3 Jackass movies. So at a certain point, you're just going to have to get comfortable with the idea that not everything that makes money is good. And it doesn't mean that it's good because it makes money. Like, I got real comfortable with that sometime around the first Jackass movie.
No, I mean, I did. It's really funny you mentioned that. I was just thinking about that yesterday. I was thinking about that particular era of films and was like, well, what are you going to do? I mean, Jackass movies were making money. So it's not exactly an era that will be remembered as the peak of cinema. I was thinking about it in context of, you know, how people are really shitting on what's going on in cinema today. And I'm like, you know what? I'll take this era over Paranormal Activity, Saw, Release Weekends, and Jackass, a Jackass movie every year.
Dude, that any fucking day. Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, is one of the most racist movies I've seen since Birth of a Nation. Like, it is...
Wow, that's a bold fucking
dude,
statement.
Dude, there's literally a kid in that movie, which is all about a Hispanic family growing up in a Hispanic community, getting haunted, that's wearing a shirt that says, I love beans. Guys, calm the fuck on with this horse shit. Anyway... Yes, I don't. I'm gonna get down off the soapbox, and people can keep making drinks at the
Stargrove.
There we go. So, but that is one of the great things about the script, is they managed for everything to go wrong, and nothing, as far as the writing and the comedy and the skill of the script, feels out of control. And that's also saying something, considering there are big moments of this movie that I remember and love that were improvised. One of the best of those is the conversation on the train when they literally hitch a ride on a boxcar like a couple of traveling hobos. And Charles Grodin says to Robert De Niro, did you think any of those farm animals were attractive? And apparently that was Martin Brest told Charles Grodin, say something that you know will even make Robert De Niro laugh. And that's what he came up with. And sure as shit, yeah, De Niro laughs at that. And his response, which is so great, is, I don't know, there were a couple of chickens I might have taken a pass at.
Yeah.
Which is such a... And then on top of that, there's a... Robert De Niro gives his character, and this pun is fine. It's intentional. There's a tic that he has where he's constantly, constantly checking his watch. Like, all the time checking his watch. It's like this nervous tic that he has. And the explanation of that, which was entirely De Niro's idea, is so...
like your heart breaks for the guy. Like, and this is after the scene where he goes back and has to ask his ex-wife for money when they are stranded and the opposing bail bondsman gets his credit card cut off, which, by the way, apparently in 1988, you could just call and cut off somebody else's credit card with almost no identifying information whatsoever.
Yes.
That is fucking insane to me.
It was a very weird time in which identity theft wasn't a thing that everyone was aware of yet. And it was having a credit card was a strange thing in the 80s to begin with. Not everybody had credit cards. That was a thing that it was a lot like cell phones for a while. It was something that only an exclusive few had. And then slowly more and more people got them to the point that life just suddenly became hard and people thought you were weird if you didn't have one. But so, yeah, at the time it was the thing about that scene is it was not so easy to steal stuff that way, but to cancel a card was. And he gave the number.
Yeah,
so he had the number and he had the guy's actual name, and he did that beautiful social engineering there, where, because it's a great social engineering moment in that scene. That's why I totally forgive any possible legal weirdness with that scene, because he's like, my name is Jack. No, John Henry. Like, he acts like, oh, hey, yeah, I just said the name that everybody calls me, but you've got me under this. And then, oh, yeah, I've got that number right here, yada, yada. You know what? What was my last? Okay, yeah, it was the train. Yes, okay, I remember that. You know what? Why don't you just go ahead and cancel that card? Which they were just like, okay, yeah. No random stranger would call up and cancel someone's card after having all that information, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they in this movie they did. But still, the only thing in this movie that bothers me is the one punch. Like, the one punch knockouts. Like, the first few times, but like by the eighth time, he knocks somebody out with a single gold cock.
I did get you down, Ray. I did get you down. It's just him doing Raging Bull again. I'm okay with that, honestly. Like, that tracks in my mind. But yeah, no, it is a weird thing that kind of dates this movie a little bit. But that being said, I feel like this is a movie that...
It is a movie.
Could be remade today because of what we were talking about, because we are in an era where we've kind of swung back, because of what's going on in society, swung back away from characters who are going to step on everything to get the job. Like, we don't really want that character right now. Like,
no,
we're not embracing
that
character.
That's the thing I was thinking about in terms of this era. It's why the Jackass movies came to my mind. There's a reason why superhero movies do so well right now. We pine for the good guys.
Yep.
We want people who make the right moral choice. These are our heroes right now. We don't want the anti-heroes. We want the heroes. And if they are anti-heroes, it's still stuff like Deadpool where he's still doing the right thing. He just murders a lot of people doing it.
Right. Sure.
We don't want to watch 35-year-old men hit each other in the balls over and over again. There was a time where you could really make a lot of money hitting your buddies in the balls, but those days are done and we want our heroes.
I don't know sager words that have ever been spoken. I tell you this, now I pine for the follow-up to Captain America Civil War being Tony Stark finds a rogue Steve Rogers and has to bring him back to trial, and you have basically...
I'm glad that's where it went. I was like, where Tony Stark nutshots.
No. Where it's basically Midnight Run, but it's Iron Man taking Captain America back to the fucking Hague to stand for war crimes, and then like all the other superheroes getting in the way. And you know what? Yaphet Kotto, still in there, because I said so.
You mentioned that. Hold on. Pull out the guitar.
Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
So just after this came out, early 90s, there was this thing in syndication called the Action Pack.
Ah, yes.
And the Action Pack.
I'm so glad we're going to talk about this.
The Action Pack was essentially a launching ground for TV shows, where they would show pilots for TV shows, and the ones that people responded to would turn into TV shows. One of the things on the Action Pack was a movie about Hercules starring Kevin Sorbo. Another thing on the Action Pack was a TV version of Midnight Run.
Now, I'm going to demonstrate the differences in ages between the two of us by responding to what you just said by saying, yes, I know about the action pack. I saw it on YouTube. Because oh, I did.
I watched it every Saturday fucking evening when it was on because it was bowled right up the middle of what 15-year-old Cargill wanted to fucking watch.
Now, what I noticed about the way they advertised those three Midnight Run made-for-TV backdoor pilots, which were Midnight Run Again, Midnight Run Around, and Midnight Run for Your Life, starring Christopher McDonald, better known as Shooter McGavin from Happy Gilmore. What I noticed is when they advertise that on the screen, because this is the thing I miss about network TV is when
by the way, Action Pack wasn't network.
I'm sorry.
Action Pack was syndication.
Right. It was local. It was local.
It was sold to all the local markets.
Even more so, that's what I'm talking about, is when you would get to the end of the promo and there would just be a bad still image on the screen and the background of that would be very colorful. It would have the name of the show and the time. Because when they did that for the Action Pack for Midnight Runaround, it just said Midnight Run. Like they were literally, they were asyluming it before there was an asylum, trying to trick people into thinking that what they were actually watching was the movie Midnight Run. Like Midnight Run at 8. I'm like, it's not called Midnight Run. It's called Midnight Runaround.
It was Midnight Run, Midnight Runaround.
No. There are three of them. There's Midnight Run.
No. I know. But what they were, it was the Midnight Run show. And here's the name of, it was
this week on Midnight Run.
Yeah.
Which is a show I would have watched.
That's what they were going for. In fact, they pitched it as a show when it came out. Like it was, these movies were supposed to be, and they talked about, if you like these movies, we will make more of these. So watch them and tell your friends.
Hence Backdoor Pilot. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a really interesting experiment at the time, or at least we thought it was, because it's like, hey, shit, this is kind of cool. Like if I like this, they'll make more of them. The thing we got out of that was Hercules, and Hercules led to Xena. So the Action Pack eventually gave us Xena Warrior Princess. So for a large portion of nerddom, especially female and LGBT nerddom, the Action Pack has a special little place in history for having given us the first kind of representation that really galvanized female geekdom. Yeah. So that came out of it. We never did get a full-on Midnight Run TV series.
It's almost as if you need all of the elements of this movie, or at least comparable elements. Like, no disrespect for Christopher McDonald, and Dan Hedaya took over the Joe Pantoliano role in the sort of made-for-TV version, so that... I'm okay with that move, but outside of that, you need a little bit more. You need somebody, like we mentioned the screenplay and how good it is. We didn't actually mention that the screenwriter is George Gallo, who also wrote Bad Boys and Bad Boys 2.
Yes.
So, again, so many people involved in this movie are alums.
A master of the buddy movie.
Now, and we also haven't mentioned the two most surprising words in all of Midnight Run. Danny Elfman.
I was going to mention that. Danny Elfman doing a score that sounds absolutely nothing like Danny Elfman, but
nothing.
It's great.
Every time Yaphet Kotto is in his office, it sounds like he's being followed by the ghost of B.B. King. It does not sound like Danny Elfman.
No. And you hear that music and you instantly know you're watching Midnight Run.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
It's big, it's happy.
It's bluesy as all
it's
fuck.
It's really bluesy. But again, that's the weird thing about Danny Elfman. Danny Elfman, most of you know him as...
Tim Burton's collaborator.
Well, as the Tim Burton collaborator, as this very definitive, weird, kooky sound. Danny Elfman got his start as first a cult musician in a group called the Knights of the Oingo Boingo that would do comedy shows and music shows in LA, a lot of which was retro stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the thing is he's a guy who is as obsessed with the 1930s as we are with like the 70s and 80s. Like it was that kind of a thing. It was that kind of a throwback. And then they spun off into an actual pop group called Oingo Boingo. And he eventually left and became a film composer. And so for most people, you know, listening to this podcast, he is just a film composer. To someone like Old Man Cargill, he is somebody who was in a big, huge band that had a song in the fucking Ghostbusters movie, which fucking rocked, and who you'd hear on the radio a lot, and who, you know, you hear him, you know, you hear them doing Weird Science. Like, that's Weird Science and Dead Man's Party are probably their two biggest hits. Flesh and Blood from Ghostbusters is really fucking awesome. They were really awesome, but then he spun off and he hadn't quite found his sound yet. This is before he has established himself. He had two movies out this summer, one of which we've already talked about, Beetlejuice.
Yes.
And then this one. And they could not sound more different. But you can hear a lot of the stuff that Danny Elfman obsessed over with the Knights of the Oingo Boingo. That was happy and upbeat and poppy before they went off and made new wave stuff. That was the thing about Oingo Boingo, was they were very new wave. They were very odd. They were very cutting edge stuff there for a while. But here is a guy who's really, really trying to be someone who does a score rather than trying to be Danny Elfman. And the Danny Elfman who would then leave, what, Spider-Man 2, saying, if you want me to copy other people's work and sound like something else, then you've got the wrong guy. because Danny Elfman really, had created this sound. And when you hear most of Danny Elfman's scores, you don't need to see his name up on screen. He is more prominent. You can generally see here a Danny Elfman score you've never heard before and identify Danny Elfman more than you'd identify John Williams or James Horner or any of those guys. Like, he has so painted himself into a corner.
Just imagine, though, if you were listening to a movie scored by James Horner, and for that movie, James Horner's like, you know what? I don't need a brass section for this one. I'm going to do something different. You'd be like, how the fuck is this a James Horner score? That's how I felt listening to the Midnight Run score. And I remember Danny Elfman came up on the screen and like, I don't remember Danny Elfman doing the score for this. Oh, because it doesn't sound like it's remotely anything in his wheelhouse.
Anything, but it's fantastic.
It's amazing. It's so fucking good.
Yeah.
And you're right. As soon as you hear that music, the very distinctive fonts of the title card. I don't feel like we talk about fonts enough, but there is a font with this title card.
I think we talk about font the right amount.
What the Helvetica are you talking about? We do not talk about fonts enough.
I think we do.
I think we can get a lot of Comic Sans out of talking about...
Oh, go to hell. Vetica.
It's fun because we hate ourselves. This, yeah.
It's fun because we drink the pain away.
We do.
How's that tall boy treating you?
So good. The Salisbury Special, a six-pack of Lone Star Tall Boys. Anyway, I do want to mention a couple of other things about just the making of this movie, one of which being that apparently Charles Grodin is in, I mentioned The Defiant once, he's in handcuffs so much in this movie that he actually developed real scars from having to work so much in handcuffs. And there was also this great thing where Yaphet Kotto did not get along with Martin Brest, called him hair director, because he did a lot of takes. Robert De Niro, who, by the way, had another director that he called Marty. Like, you read all this stuff about this movie, he goes, yeah, I trusted Marty to do this. I'm like, okay, Bob, I'm going to call you Bob because you're calling Martin Brest Marty. And if Robert De Niro is talking about a director and calling him Marty, I'm not thinking Martin Brest. You'll have to excuse me. I'm thinking of a different Marty. Just going to say that. But Yaphet Kotto was like, you know, Robert De Niro is so spontaneous. He does all these things. But then Martin Brest wants to get every single version on camera. And he's like, I was sick through the course of making this movie. So half the time you see me on screen, I've got 103 fever. And it's just like, holy shit, Yaphet Kotto did not have fun making this movie.
He's so good at it, though.
He's amazing in this movie.
Probably that may have all worked together because his character is just perpetually upset with everybody. So that's very method to hate everybody around you and then play a character who hates everybody around him.
Hey, do I make myself understood? Do I make myself understood? God, when Yaphet Kotto says, do I make myself...
Is this going to upset me?
I think there's a good chance. I've never seen an FBI agent roll their eyes more than Yaphet Kotto in this movie, and it's so fucking
But that's
good.
What's so great when he and Robert De Niro hook up. There's this look on his face like he smiles, and it's like, finally, somebody competent. And it's the guy we've been chasing. Like, this makes so much sense now.
It's true. It's entirely true. Yeah, this is a great, great, great movie. I mean, if I had any complaints, honestly, it is that It's a very long movie. Like, the midnight runtime of this film is pretty extensive. And there are a couple of points where you're going to feel it a little bit because you feel like they're taking every mile from New York to L.A. at certain points.
I don't think there's a minute of wasted screen time in this movie.
I'm not saying it's wasted. I'm just saying you feel that
like we've been talking about. I've been moving. I've had a lot of stuff going on in my life. I've had some stuff due. So I was like, well, I've seen this movie a million times. I can crunch this in. I can watch the 2-hour movie in about an hour and a half by skipping through the. I didn't skip a goddamn second. Like we ended, I just ended up losing that half an hour because I'm like, no, I really need to watch this. This movie's too fucking good. I didn't skip a goddamn thing, but the credits.
Absolutely. So. No. And I'm on board with that 100%. And actually Roger Ebert, I believe, this was on their Siskel and Ebert's best of the year list, obviously. And I go back to Ebert a lot, but he said, this sounds like formula, and it is a formula, but Midnight Run is not a formula movie because the writing and acting make these two characters into specific quirky individuals whose relationship becomes more interesting even as the chase grows more predictable, which this is a chase movie, 100%. Everyone is chasing these two guys, and you do see a lot of, you know, the standard cop car chases, although the one that I love in this movie that I've never seen anything like is the chase through just uneven terrain.
The desert.
It's just, it's not
Sedona.
Even, it's not a high speed chase. It's not a chase through like a really elaborate set. It's just trying to drive on very uneven ground and the dangers of doing that.
Driving through the Sedona desert, which is a nightmare. Like it's not fucking flat. And so everybody crashes, even them, which is what's so interesting about
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic.
What about there goes $100,000. $100,000. Anybody was going to pay you $100,000?
Why? What was he going to pay you?
$25,000.
Oh.
Son of a bitch.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And this is one of the rare occasions where we have an embarrassment of riches. There are so many things we could pick.
Yeah,
in this
I'm sure
movie.
You and I have both picked something different as usual.
It's because it's like constantly characters are eating. I mean, the rival bail bondsman played by John Ashton is like in two different scenes of this movie in a hotel room eating what looks to be a basket of ribs. Like he's the fucking little like he's Billy Barty from Masters of the Universe. Chorizo and eggs makes an appearance in the movie. You know, Charles Grodin talks about a potato dish with onion, like on and on and on and on and on and on and on. But to bring it into the local flair of Austin, because we've already mentioned it, I'm definitely going to go with fried chicken. But specifically, I'm going to go with a fried chicken that pairs, much like the buddies of this movie that pairs so well together. The chicken and waffles at Lucy's is going to be my junk food pairing, which, by the way, Austin, if you haven't been to Lucy's, for the love of God, go to fucking Lucy's.
All right.
Such amazing fried
so
chicken.
So I'm gonna seize up on something that you mentioned. I'm going to tie a little bit of this together. I'm not tying it together with Austin. That is a great call. Like, Lucy's is where I go to get my fried chicken because it's fucking great. Mm-hmm. I'm going to seize on chorizo and eggs.
There you
but
go.
But I'm specifically going to go to, in Sedona, Arizona, there is a place called The Kettle. And The Kettle was a place made for me and Brian. Like, it was designed for me and Brian. Not only does it name drop all these names along the walls of people who have eaten there with all these photos, headshots, but it offers a menu on newsprint that has 100 options. They are a menu with over 100 omelets. Now, of course, you could modify those omelets, so you could really get as many as you want. But there's literally just... They build themselves as home of 100 omelets, and those omelets fucking kill. It is great all-day breakfast. So if you find yourself in Sedona, go grab yourself one of 100 omelets at The Kettle. It is amazing.
Which is a great choice because this movie, I feel like this concept had been done 100 different ways before this, has been done 100 different ways since this, but Midnight Run is still singular. It is still a standalone, standout, wholly original, unique movie, and I am so in love with it. I'm so glad we got to talk about it. It is absolutely one of the best movies of 1988. It was a monster hit, and I am shocked that we didn't get a theatrical sequel to it.
Can you imagine what it must have been like for the exec that put Midnight Run into turnaround?
Oof.
The guy's like, no, we want Cher.
Yeah.
Fuck Charles Grodin. Do you imagine what every Monday morning had to be like when the guy in the office who hated him came in and said, oh, hey, did you see the weekend numbers?
Oh, man.
Not saying you made a bad call. I don't know that we would have been able to make that movie.
You got me, and baby, I got your job. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter and Instagram, at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. And this week.
Boom.
This fucking week.
Boom, boom.
We are, it comes out, baby. We Are Where the Nightmares Go, my brand new book, available in print, available in ebook, available in audiobook. Wherever you buy your books, you can get a copy of this book. 10 very, at times, junky short stories and novellas. There's zombie dinosaurs, possessing ghosts, hilarious rednecks. It is, it runs the gamut, plus a new Colby story. I'm proud of the book. I hope you guys enjoy it. It comes out Tuesday, the 12th.
I still maintain that at one point last year, Cargill and I did a show in Omaha, and there was a brief window of time where we thought we were going to have to rent a car and drive there. And I maintain that the title, We Are Where the Nightmares Go, is something that you got from thinking about what that road trip with me would have been like.
Yeah.
We Are Where the Nightmares Go. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. And of course, you can find the show at Junk Food Cinema. And if you like it, you can always go back our whole catalog on Blog Talk Radio and on iTunes. Subscribe, 5-star ratings, reviews. We'd love to read all that. If you really like the show, I'm going to pitch it just one more time. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, great way for you to keep the lights on here, again, hilariously, as we're turning them off in old Junk Food HQ. But to go out, I just want to remind you guys that whether you get the information from moron number one or moron number two, you need to make sure that you make yourself understood. Okay, you know what? Show's over. Nothing personal, but fuck off.